How a world conflict became communication quicksand on college campuses. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, June 11th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Frontline and Retro Report bring you Crisis on Campus. It's a look at how the war in Gaza fueled campus protests across the U.S., why some of those protests were accused of anti-Semitism, and the race to control the narrative of oppressor and oppressed. James Jacoby is with us. Teacher Talk explores the impact of summer reading programs in South Dakota. It's more than a librarian with a book. Plus, historic wet plate photography returns to the Black Hills. We'll get to know an artist who is taking the art form forward. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. After Hamas militants killed more than 1,000 Israelis on October 7th, Israel retaliated and scrambled to prevent future attacks. The death toll in Gaza is reportedly more than 37,000 Palestinians. Meanwhile, an intense conflict about the conflict broiled on U.S. college campuses. A new PBS Frontline documentary investigates Crisis on Campus premieres tonight. I spoke with director James Jacoby yesterday.
Right after the Hamas attack on October 7th, you obviously had both Israeli and Jewish students kind of reeling from this attack, you know, worried about what it meant, who was affected. And as the details were sort of rolling out, even that day, there were pro-Palestinian student groups that were issuing statements, not just at Ivy League schools, but all around the country. In response to this attack. And these are student groups that have been a part of advocating for the Palestinian cause for a long time, saw, I think, an opportunity with this October 7th attack to kind of contextualize it and say, look, this attack doesn't just exist and come in a vacuum. It comes because there's a long history of occupation and grievances going back to 1948 for the Palestinian people. And a lot of these student groups came out with these statements right in the wake of this attack. And that is when this conflict over the conflict really got baked in. I mean, it was immediate, because obviously then there was kind of a reckoning among not just Jewish and Israeli students, but lots of universities, of like, who issues statements that sort of kind of justify or seem to contextualize this attack, when, you know, it's still unclear as to what's happened, who's been killed, how many hostages have been taken. So there seemed to be, at least from the Jewish community and others, a sense that this was so insensitive to something. But also at the same time, you had these Palestinian student groups that thought that this was exactly the sort of time that they wanted to bring attention to the longer plight of the Palestinians.
Tell us a little bit about what you learned from the Palestinian students at Harvard in particular, about how they were treated after they released a statement that their critics say failed to hold Hamas responsible. But they say that's not what this was really about. It was time to tell people about what's happening in Gaza.
Right. Well, first of all, I'm really glad you had that as a takeaway from the film, because I've always seen this as a film in which there are warring narratives, and there's really an effort by people on all sides of this issue to try to define the narrative. And it is modern, and it is a media story. It's a social media story. So much of the information that these students are getting about the war and disseminating about the war is on social media, which of course we know is filled with echo chambers and misinformation and froths people up and kind of exacerbates some extremes. But, you know, in terms of what some of these students experienced that were the Palestinian or pro-Palestinian students, is that once they put out this statement, for instance, at Harvard, they were attacked immediately for being anti-Semitic. They were attacked immediately for being pro-Hamas, or because they did not mention Hamas in their initial statement. They blamed Israel entirely for all unfolding violence. That was their statement. It was signed by 30 plus student groups at Harvard. And so there was a combination of both people on campus, and as well as prominent donors and alumni, politicians, others who piled on and said these students, one, the university and Claudine Gay, who was the president of Harvard at the time, needed to disassociate itself from these students, needed to condemn the student statement, needed to, you know, some people called for their names to be released, for them to be doxxed. Doxing trucks or, you know, trucks with billboards with people's faces on them, with calling them Harvard's leading anti-Semites, arrived on Harvard's campus, other campuses around the country where you had similar student statements. So it was a an almost immediate onslaught that a lot of these students faced who had issued statements like this.
And lest we blame a bunch of college students for spending too much time on social media, the theatrics of the congressional hearings are also something that trip up the college presidents because they maybe fail to understand the social media moment that people in Congress are setting them up for. So how do the congressional hearings feed in to the division of all of this on the campus itself?
These presidents from the very beginning were in such a bind, you know, in dealing with the fact that there was this war of narratives. Some people saying that, you know, these pro-Palestinian student statements in some ways were not just offensive, but kind of some form of harassment. We've also seen on these campuses a lot of different chants arise, you know, globalize the intifada, localize the intifada, intifada being the Arabic word for uprising, also connotes a brutal period of history in Israel's rather recent history, in which a lot of Jews were killed and a lot of Palestinians were killed. You also had from the river to the sea, which is a chant that's cropped up, which some people on these campuses see as a genocidal chant. And so you have this extremely charged language in this conflict that comes at a time after we've been hearing for now the past 5 or 10 years that we're so sensitive to all sorts of identity issues and sensitivities on campuses, you know, whether it be about transgender issues and people's pronouns or trigger warnings happening in our classrooms, that there's been kind of this movement over the past 5 to 10 years to really try to make sure that we have inclusive environments. Yet all of a sudden we have people on these campuses chanting things that some Jewish students feel are absolutely more than offensive, but threatening. And so you have these college presidents who are in this position of having basically two legal obligations that are in conflict with one another. One is, you know, a necessity to kind of allow for free speech, especially at public universities. Private universities, it's a bit different. And two, protecting students because there's civil rights laws from discrimination or harassment because of their ethnic identity on campus. And so, you know, these chants like River to the Sea or Globalize the Intifada, if there are students that find this threatening and think that these are calls for violence, what's a university president to do? And so then getting to the congressional hearing, you know, the House Republicans on the Education Committee call a hearing, ostensibly looking into, campus anti-Semitism. And Elise Stefanik of New York has a moment where she basically challenges each of these college presidents on, you know, would calling for the genocide of Jews violate your code of conduct? And these presidents have a very tricky time answering a very tricky hypothetical question, because mind you, no one has actually called for the genocide of Jews on these campuses. This was kind of her interpretation of some of these chants. And they gave what, I mean, can be kindly said as a poor performance. And it was a major viral moment for Elise Stefanik and for the Republicans on that committee, because it it showed that these presidents had these kind of equivocating answers about what seemed to be a very clear-cut moral question.
And From the River to the Sea, I think you do a really masterful job of talking to people in this film about what that means, how it translates. Why would some people think that that was anti-Semitic? Here is why. And one of your guests says, the people who know what they're saying know what they're saying. He acknowledges that there are many people who are saying this, not thinking it means this area will be Arab and there will be no Jews present. But there are people who are saying it who do know that. And what you said about some Jewish students and some protesters, this is so nuanced. When you get into and into the crowds, how many people were you talking to that had a hard time or were disinclined to think it was nuanced at all and had made a black and white decision, a yes or no decision about what needed to be done?
Yeah, the film ends with a quote from Carol Crist, who was the longtime chancellor at UC Berkeley. She is saying something at the end of the film that really resonates, and that's why we end with it, which is about the fact that there seems to be less of an ability for students to kind of speak to one another on really difficult issues like this. And I noticed, at least in the reporting and spending a lot of time on campuses, a lot of time with students, that I was kind of consistently astonished by the pro versus anti aspect of this. Mm-hmm. That is, this was such a binary conflict with very little room for nuance or gray area, that you're either pro-Israel or you're anti-Israel, you're either pro-Palestinian or anti-Palestinian. And as someone who's actually covered the actual conflict as opposed to the conflict over the conflict, we know that it's an extremely messy conflict and there's a lot of nuance to it. And it just was sort of surprising to me, the level of division. And I found it rather, disheartening. And of course, that doesn't mean that there are plenty of, as you said, I'm cautious to say that some of the protesters, not all, there were plenty of Jewish students that are part of the pro-Palestinian movement. They might consider themselves anti-Zionist, but they're Jews. It's a very complex position to take. It's an interesting position. It's nuanced. There are also obviously pro-Palestinian Arab and Muslim students or Palestinian students that believe that Israel should exist as a Jewish state too. So there's people on all sides of this. But I did find that the level writ large of kind of black and white thinking was shockingly prevalent.
The best journalism that I saw coming out of this at the time was often student journalists, WKCR at Columbia, who were on the campus. They knew which buildings were which. They could have access to students. They had pieces of paper taped to their back that just said student journalist. Police moved them off of campus. You, as a more experienced journalist, what did you see coming out of some of those student newspapers, student radio stations, with the challenge of just covering this as a journalist?
Yeah. And it's in no way a disparagement of my colleagues at the major papers, but I do think that some of the, if not the best coverage that I read, and most accurate in terms of what it felt like to be on these campuses, mm-hmm. came from student journalists. I was really impressed with the film spends a lot of time at Harvard and Columbia. So you have the Harvard Crimson, the Columbia Spectator. Both did a phenomenal job of covering these, both the administrations of their schools, as well as the protest movement and the counter-protest movement and all of it. They've done a very good job. And I thought that, as you mentioned, but KCRW, some of the radio reporting was, especially during the New York City Police Department raid at Columbia, was extraordinary. So I think student journalists have really been an amazing part of this story, and I hats off to them for informing their readers and people beyond the school about what's been happening.
The hearings in Congress, they do not at first involve Columbia's Manu Shafiq. She gets a little more time to prep because she's out of the country. She has made a decision, presumably after watching the train wreck. And she says, yes, calling for genocide does, in fact, violate our policies. And she calls in the New York PD. She has to go to the Student Senate at Columbia and ask for permission to bring the police on. The Student Senate says, no, this is not violent. She makes the decision that, yes, it is. This emboldens people in a way to do more protest. Again, was there any way that she could win?
Shafiq also was in the position not just of saying that this is violent. There was also the aspect of that, you know, she was making the determination that this encampment that had cropped up at Columbia was sort of impeding the functioning of the university. And also there were various constituencies, you know, that were coming to her and saying, this isn't okay. Everybody from, you know, the sanitation department in New York City, people kind of signing letters, thousands of people in some cases saying that, you know, should there be an encampment on campus in which some students are saying Zionists are not allowed, right? I mean, is that okay on a college campus for that to exist? So there was, it was a very complicated situation.
Yeah.
And yes, it was peaceful for the most part, but there were also Jewish students and others that were reporting some pretty gnarly things about it. And so again, she'd been in front of Congress, she'd promised Congress to kind of crack down on things. And she was, there were lots of constituencies saying she should, and she ended up doing it. And so she's certainly not alone. When other encampments cropped up all around the country from, you know, New York to all the way to California and everywhere in between, you had presidents that had to make similar decisions, even at schools that were not being hauled in front of Congress, even at schools that have a strong principle of free speech protections, like University of Chicago, for instance. That president there said, no, they can't just camp out on campus indefinitely. You know, you're going to have to go at some point. It's not saying we're taking away your right to protest.
Having covered the conflict and then covering the conflict about the conflict, how do those two intersect? Does the conflict about the conflict influence American policy at all?
We haven't seen that yet, right? There was a moment there when we saw the Biden administration say that they weren't going to send certain bombs to Israel, the kind of 2,000 or 3,000 pound bombs that had been used in other sieges. They weren't going to send those in case the Israelis, the IDF, went into Rafah. And we saw for a moment them kind of take a red line on something. And some speculated that that may have been kind of a nod to the student movement and the movement more generally in the progressive wing of the Democratic Party to really try to, you know, get the Biden administration to change its stance on Israel's war. That was short-lived, and I don't think we've really seen that happen. I think the larger implications for American foreign policy have to do with the fact that some of our biggest allies and most important allies in Europe and elsewhere are questioning Israel's war and its policies. That's going to have, I think, a far greater impact on at least this administration's policies. But I do, you do bring up the election, and I think that yes, we can kind of set that aside. But I do think that there are going to be major political implications for this election year because of this student movement and because of the Biden administration's stance on the war.
Did you find anything that encouraged you about this generation of college students?
Whatever your opinion may be about the wars that the United States has been involved with, either directly or indirectly over the past, let's say, 20 years, right? We didn't see a lot of engagement, student engagement, around the Iraq war or Afghanistan war. We maybe did for a moment about Iraq, but it was short-lived and it wasn't, wasn't all that robust, I don't think. And you didn't see, hardly any about Afghanistan. And so here, we are certainly seeing a huge amount of student engagement. I think it's important, though, to put this in context, because there has been, because it's been such an important media story this year, you could have gone to any number of college campuses this year and not known at all that this was going on. And I think that's a really important thing to say, right? That this wasn't like something that, yes, it was disruptive around certain graduations. It intensified this spring. But, you know, there were days where we'd be shooting at Harvard or any of these campuses that were at the epicenter of this crisis. You never would have known there was a crisis there, right? This was very much something that was in part a media narrative, but it was a true crisis. I mean, I'm not here to say it wasn't. But I do think that... that, you know, this is not a huge overall subset of youth groups and youth politics. And I think that's important to recognize. But yes, I think that I spoke to a lot of people in this film who said, you know, there was a lot of apathy about other military engagements and about a lot of other choices in terms of American foreign policy. And some people told me it's great to see a generation of people activated and thinking about these things deeply, or at least more deeply and more engaged than previous generations.
That was James Jacoby, director of PBS Frontline's Crisis on Campus. It premieres tonight. Catch it on SDPB TV, 9 p.m. Central, 8 Mountain. You can also watch online at pbs.org/frontline, Frontline's YouTube page, and on the PBS app starting tonight. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The official start of summer is just a few days away, but for South Dakota readers, a new summer of reading has already begun, and librarians have been planning since January. For today's Teacher Talk, Jackie Wilbur and Gina Benz discuss the impact of summer reading programs at your local library. Gina Benz teaches Teacher Pathway and AP English at Roosevelt High School in Sioux Falls. She is a recipient of the Milken Educator Award. Jackie Wilbur is director of the Center for Student and Professional Services in the School of Education at the University of South Dakota in Vermilion.
I'm excited to talk about the summer reading program. It was one of my favorite things as a kid. I wrote a previous blog called I Love the Library, and I talked about how Book It was one of my favorite things as a child, getting free pizza for reading. But then the summer reading program was just even more magical. And then when I had the opportunity to work as a children's librarian or a youth services librarian, I got to be part of the librarian side of the summer reading program, which was very eye-opening and exciting.
So I want to know what happens behind the scenes as librarians start planning summer reading.
The summer is most definitely the busiest time at the library, and gearing up for summer programming starts as early as January, sometimes sooner for those bigger speakers. And so...
What do you mean, bigger speakers?
Well, I worked at the Omaha Public Library, and so we would coordinate. A very popular speaker group was like the zoo people, the people who would bring in animals or reptiles or things like that. And so you have to get on their calendar early so that way you can make sure that they can come to your library and they're not already booked up.
I love that. I love that, too. That makes me happy.
Yep. Or like popular kids musicians or things like that. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's talk about some of the programs that exist at I think almost every library in South Dakota probably has a story time. Somebody's reading stories.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever went to a story time as a child, though.
Oh, really?
Not at a public library.
No, I didn't either.
I lived in the country. You know,
me too.
If you're rural, that would be a drive in.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
To go to a public library in your town and hear the story time, and that was not something that we did. We read a lot. We had books, but not until I was an adult did I see adults in a library setting doing story time.
And you didn't either, Gina?
No, again, I grew up on a farm and my parents were working during the day. I had a babysitter who came over and we watched a lot of soap operas.
I love that.
A whole different kind of story.
Well, did you, Jackie?
I did. Lucky. I was really lucky. I grew up in Yankton, South Dakota. They had, it might have been more than weekly. We went once a week. My mom took my sisters and I. Yes, I have very fond memories of doing that. The art projects, after the stories, learning the alphabet, singing the songs, having someone who has great inflection and excellent storytelling skills and their ability to kind of anticipate what's coming on the next page. Learning the art of that when I became a librarian was so special to me. I took a course called Supercharged Storytime that all of the youth services librarians went through, and the in-depth knowledge that goes into choosing the books, how you present these things, the way you're priming young people to learn to read and write is very deliberate. And so I have newfound respect for the art of story time. And also it's very simple. You go bring children that you love in your life to the library and they read to you. And it is simply that, but those skills that they're learning and practicing from being at story time really do help prime them to learn to read.
Give us an example of something that might go unnoticed in a library story time that's actually priming someone to learn how to read.
The fact that there's a difference between letters and pictures. So in story time, you might point out, I always did a letter of the day. I had a magical hat and I would do this rhyme about bring us a magical letter rhyme, and would pull out the letter of the day and we would talk about what that letter was and what shapes it was making. And then we would kind of incorporate it throughout the whole story time. And I would point out whatever that letter was at certain points in the book. Young people can't differentiate between letters and pictures. It's all shapes to them. So just the fact that there is something called letters, they are differentiated from the pictures on the page. That primes them to learn to read.
Jackie, you've been holding out on me. You had a magical hat.
Yeah, I did.
What did it look like?
It looked like a wizard hat, probably. So it was like a big purple hat, and it had silver and gold stars on it.
Do you still have it?
No, the library owns it, so it stayed with the next librarian.
When I was taking my daughter to story time at the library in Sioux Falls, I became enchanted with the felt board.
Oh, I love the felt board.
And I checked out from the library collection books on felt board stories. And I went home and I bought interfacing and I traced the little things and I made my own felt board stories and I would do them for her at home just because I enjoyed it. I mean, she liked it too. And then she would tell the story with the pieces of felt herself. For those who don't have any idea what I'm talking about, Jackie, the felt board as a storytelling device in a library. What's the point of that? Because I just thought it was enchanting.
Sure. So one of the things, the felt board can do so many aspects of story time, but for everyone, it just kind of looks like a board with a piece of felt on it because that's what it is. And then you can make different cutouts in felt and then felt sticks to felt. So you can just put it on there or you can put Velcro and stick things on there. So when you're telling a story, I'm trying to think of ones that we had felt board stories for. I think I talked about Chicka Chicka Boom Boom one time on here. We had all the letters from Chicka Chicka Boom Boom, which are all the letters of the alphabet, plus a coconut tree. And then we had the way they looked in the story, too. So there's that loose tooth T. There's a letter T that has a loose tooth on it. So when you're telling the story, which is about all of these letters going up a coconut tree, you can then, on the felt board, walk them up the coconut tree, for instance. And so then the main point of that story is to say, oh no, there's all these letters in the tree, what's going to happen? And so kids can kind of visually get excited with you as you start walking these different letters up the tree, wow, that's a lot of letters in the tree, I don't know if it's going to work out. You also can do it for prediction or retelling purposes. A lot of times in story time, you'll briefly go back through the story and kind of help the kids recall what happened, and the felt board can help with that. You also can play games. We would play this game called Little Mouse, where there's just different houses on the felt board and there was a mouse hiding behind one of them, and the kids would guess, oh, it's behind the purple house or the red house, and then it would be behind whatever house you had hidden it behind, and the kids would love that. Pro tip, don't hide it behind the yellow house. They can always see the mouse on the other side.
The things that you learn. Story time gone wrong. Okay, so let's bump it up to some older kids with teen and adult programming.
Yeah.
Gina, what stands out to you is good programming at a library for high school students, for example?
First of all, I just think the presence of a library is so important during the summer because they don't have access to their school library. And here's what I know, mostly anecdotally, but I hear it from other sources as well. And that's that students who do well in school, do well on the ACT reading portion, are readers.
Yeah.
And so it's so essential that they have access to books and they don't have to pay for them. And then when they have these charts and competitions, it makes it all the more fun.
Yeah. Sometimes the library is open. If the high school librarian has a program.
Sometimes.
I know some Washington High School Library had a day that you could come over the summer and check in and see the librarian and check out books and then bring them back. So,
no, and a lot of times when a school library is open, it's because special funding has been requested or a grant has been given. It's not in the normal school budget.
Okay. Jackie, teen and adult programming, what stands out to you?
I would echo what Gina said and also remind folks that you can send your kids to the library the way you send them to the pool. I would look up what the minimum age is to be able to go to the library by yourself before sending them off, but a lot of times it's 11 or 12, and so kids can walk themselves to the library and go hang out there the same way they could go hang out at the public pool. And we did a lot of fun things, I thought, for older kids. There's a lot of great family programming, like I was talking about, getting a big, you know, singer that's popular with young children, or a magician, or bringing in animals, or singers and dancers, all kinds of fun things like that. And then clubs will pick up in the summertime, too. So we had a coding club, a chess club, a Lego club. All of those were part of teen programming. And then I really enjoyed making escape rooms. That's a fun activity. I love doing that. It's basically where, well, I'm sure folks might be familiar with businesses that do exactly this on a very high-end level, where there'll be a fancy room and you have to figure out all the clues and codes to escape from the room. And the library will do that on a library level budget using library level items in one of the meeting rooms or something like that. Teens always really liked those. And some places do lock-ins where they will actually let the kids spend the night in the library. I don't know if people have brought that back post-COVID or not, but that was a pre-COVID thing that existed. And then the last thing I'll say is adults have programming too, so you can join any book clubs. There's a lot of times knitting or sewing circles. They'll pair cookbooks with cooking programs. And then there's seeds in many libraries now. There's a full seed library, so gardening has become part of library community too.
I love that. A good adult programming.
Yeah, I know of adult groups who meet at the library. They choose that as their meeting place, and they reserve a meeting room. I think that's another good service the library offers.
Yeah. Yes.
Let's talk about prizes for a minute, because some, you know, you like the pizza, like the prizes, the bookmarks, the stickers, the posters. But sometimes we can be a little critical of programs that reward reading with pizza, because it becomes almost a cliche where there's pizza every other week because somebody read a book. So, Jackie, tell me a little bit about how you think about prizes when it comes to summer reading programs.
Yeah, I think it's a way that kids can keep track of their reading over the summer and then be rewarded one time at the end of the summer. So there's like this, depends on the local library. They all have their own way of going about how they want to do prizes. But the way it was when I was growing up and the way it was at the library where I worked was that you would sign up at the beginning of the summer and then get some kind of coloring sheet, or you can log it online or have different ways to track your progress for doing different literacy activities, reading a certain number of minutes or reading a certain number of books. And then you can turn that in at the end of the summer to get various prizes. So I do think that it's definitely the carrot method, and the libraries are designed to be fun. And so I think it is just in the name of fun and promoting literacy to say, let's celebrate that you read this summer. And so that's what they do.
What I love about the library is one of the things, you walk in and the librarians have displays. They're so good at their displays. So I'm a sucker for a good librarian display where they'll put things together, you know, it's so much better than an algorithm.
Yeah.
In the, you know, where you just, you know, type in one of your favorite books and it pops up and tells you, well, you might also like this. Curated by a librarian display is kind of that.
I think it is better because then you'll be more likely to be challenged and to step out of your comfort zone, which is really good for readers to do.
Yeah. You can find the Teacher Talk Companion blog on our website at sdpb.org/news. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Carrie Janicek combines art, history, and chemistry to create photos of the present in the style of the past. She's a North Dakota photographer who uses historic wet plate collodion. She presents in Deadwood for a History on the Lawn event this Friday. I spoke with her last week.
It is a form of photography from that it got invented in the 1850s. It was used until the 1880s. It was the most widely used form of photography during that time period. And it's what I would call monochrome. It's not exactly black and white. And there are some special things about the process. There are often little imperfections because it is a handmade image. So you'll see sometimes little dust particles, or depending on the lens you use, the depth of field is very shallow, and where you're shooting, and if it's a portrait, which is what I do primarily. So it all adds to a really great ambiance. It translates color differently since it only sees the UV spectrum. It only translates that type of light. So blue turns white, red turns black, yellow turns black, and it can kind of fool around with the tones of your skin and really make other things come out, like hidden freckles and things of that nature.
So when people watch you make a portrait, they are going to see the process itself. Tell us as a photographer what you are going through just to take one portrait.
So if I'm going on site, which is what I'll be doing shortly in South Dakota, I have to set up a remote darkroom and also set up where my camera is, which I use a giant Bellows camera. I alternate between two different ones. I have an antique mahogany one from England, which is a 10 by 12. And then I also have an 8 by 10 Swarovski camera from Poland. And those are pretty fun to see because they kind of look like an accordion. So once those are all set up, I set up my sitter, then I do the chemistry in the darkroom tent. And that, before even I've set up, I've mixed these chemicals in advance. And so when I have my dark room, I apply a chemical emulsion onto a metal or glass plate, and then I submerge it into a silver nitrate bath, which makes it sensitive to light. So then I have to have safe light conditions. And that means most people know in dark rooms you have that red light. So I use portable bicycle lights in my movable darkroom. And then I take that image out, or that one plate out of that silver bath. I then put it into what's called a plate holder. And that effectively becomes what most people would think of as a piece of film. So now I can shoot one image, and I'll come out to the sitter. I make sure that focus is really nice and tight. The sitter must hold still, or anywhere outdoors it's shorter. So I would say wide open with my lens, or even stop down a little bit. It's usually around 4 to 5 seconds, even 3 seconds outdoors. But surprisingly, it's hard to hold still even for 3 seconds. So I do use a head brace on all of my sitters just to kind of keep them still. So after that, I take that exposure, I pose that sitter, I load the plate holder, I pull the dark slide, and then I remove the lens cap and I become the shutter. So I count off those 4 seconds, let's say. I put the lens cap back on. I then put the dark slide back down, and then I return to the dark room. And I'm gone there for about 3 more minutes. And when I'm in the dark room the second time, I'm removing the plate from the holder. I'm doing in-hand chemical development in safe light conditions. And once I see the highlights begin to appear and pop up, I then submerge it into a bath of water, and that stops the development process. And then I rinse for about 20 seconds, which can be challenging if it's on site because sometimes we don't have running water. So sometimes it's just jugs of water. And then I go to a fixer bath, And that's when the image goes from a negative to a positive. And that can be done outdoors in front of the sitters. So that's the magical moment when they can see how they look, almost like time travel, how they would have looked in the 1800s.
Yeah. In the 1800s, would there have been any women doing this kind of work?
It's interesting you're asking that, because I just had a fellow wet plate artist send me a cabinet card, a picture of it, of another wet plate, or not wet plate photographer, but a photographer in the antique processes that had my last name, which is really bizarre. So I'm hoping that he'll let me buy it off of him. But it is really rare for women in this time period to get involved in photography, but there were quite a few, because this was the easiest form of technology in the photographic process available at that point in time. And so you'll see some big names that did wet plate photography. One of them is Margaret Cameron, and she primarily worked making negatives on glass and doing contact prints, which in itself is even more challenging. So definitely there were some women in the field, but it has always been primarily dominated by men.
There's a phase when you're just trying to figure out the steps and the technical mastery that you need to put forth what you envision. But then you're also an artist with an eye toward a gallery show or an individual piece of work that expresses what you want to express as an artist. Tell me a little bit about how those two things fold together or intersect for you.
That's a great question. I would like to address something that's hand in hand with this question, and that is intention versus accidental beauty. When you're beginning, there's a steep learning curve, especially with myself. I had no training in photography professionally at all. So there's a steep learning curve of just getting down the basics in a consistent manner. And occasionally these accidents that happen with this process can be quite beautiful, and it becomes a piece of artwork. The difference is it's not intentional, and there's kind of a gray area as an artist on whether it's beautiful that it happened, but it wasn't with your intent. So when you develop in skill and you get to a point where you can control sometimes the chemical changes and things, you can use it almost like an artistic tool. And some people do that. They deliberately add flaws or effects. Myself, I've always kept so far primarily to really clean plates, and definitely having under my belt now the experience to have a consistently good plate has been helpful in foreseeing my vision when it comes to an art exhibition. And I've been very grateful to have had 11 solo art exhibitions in 4 years. So I've tried my best to work within the confines of this process, but do experimental things with it, with layering, color, painting, double exposures, triple exposures. So there are some fun things you can do to convey emotion that don't involve necessarily triggering like more dust and flaws and silver splash. So it just depends on the artist. It depends on the practitioner.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Are there themes that you find yourself returning to again and again?
It's so funny. A dear friend of mine and I talk about what we do all the time. He's from overseas. And every time I have an exhibition coming up, I'm like, I'm so exhausted of trying to be emotional and having a dramatic meaning. I'm just going to go for aesthetics this time. I'm going to indulge in aesthetics. And then I always end up going back to like the emotion behind it. So a lot of my plates are inspired by music and heavily inspired by songs I'm listening to, but also the emotions that brings up or what I'm going through or something I think is important to recognize within the development of our internal world as human beings in general. And so a lot of my work is emotion-based. Even some of the more Victorian style images I've done, I usually have a storyline behind it that plays into a dramatic human emotion.
Yeah, and a lot of the female form, the female face, women looking into the camera, women in motion but yet standing still. Tell me a little bit about femininity in your work as a theme.
It just happened naturally. You know, I just ended up meeting so many amazing, talented women, and it's what I know. And I always have felt that if you're coming from a place where maybe you don't have training or don't have a specified field you're real knowledgeable about, you should make work on the subject you know firsthand, because that's going to be your best work. And obviously I know about being a woman. So the combination of just having so many wonderful, talented women, almost all of the models in my images are also artists or photographers or musicians, and having their presence around and learning from them, but also wanting to draw from what I know and the knowledge I have. And I think that I don't gravitate towards real sensualized images. Some female artists do that, or, and that's up to them what they want to do, but that's not my world. And so I've really tried to draw from the things that I think make women such an important part, and being feminine, such an important part of our history, our world, and our future going forward.
How do you think about adornment, whether it's tattoos or piercings or a hat?
The adornment that sometimes I will ask my sitter to bring something that they've made. I did mention that some of them are artists, so some of them make jewelry, some of them make outfits. So they will bring sometimes on site something that they want to be in the image, and we make it work with what we're doing. I think it's important not to go overboard. Wet plate can really carry props. Don't get me wrong. You can go pretty far. I have some of like women who are knights in armor, and you know, you can go all out if you want, but don't doing that all the time. You can take away and distract from maybe in a more emotional, subtle message you're trying to portray in the image. So choosing the props or the accessories is important. It should be done carefully.
Mm-hmm. How do you take an art form like this and move it forward?
Another good question. That is something I was extremely passionate about with two of my exhibitions, and I still try to do that occasionally, and going beyond the traditional form. And there are some people within this process, and rightly so, who want to hold completely to the tradition of what it was and keep it in that tradition. The newcomers like myself and some others who started within the last 5 years, we really want to think outside of the box and transform it so that it, you know, really push the boundaries of what it can do. So one of the things I like to do, I've done, one of my series I did was of women in space. And how I did that was I did glass collodion images, mostly with black backgrounds, so they became translucent with only the figure being there. And I would have them interacting with a image from the Hubble telescope that I would back the image with. And so it was like they were, I was using one of the oldest forms of technology and one of the most advanced forms of technology, and then also kind of showcasing that as not only is imagery eternal, but we are all made of stars. Another way I've done it is personally is I've used pottery paint to paint the back of some of my ambrotypes, the glass images. Something that you can do to not just have it as a photograph, I think, because it's such a hard process that many people, just to get a photograph of this process, becomes all-consuming. So pushing it forward can be fun. I hope that some of my work survives. I know some of it has been archived a little bit here and there. I would like some of my creative work to end up in the hands of people in the future. That's why I think it's important to have fun with it, because they will build on what you've done. If something of mine survives that's a real creative piece, I would hope that maybe someone of like mine would be inspired to go beyond what I've done with it.
Carrie Janicek presents on Historic Photography this week in Deadwood. Her History on the Lawn event is Friday, June 14th at the Historic Adams House. And you can learn more about how to sign up to be a sitter for those sessions at deadwoodhistory.com. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. Tomorrow on the program, Enormous Sculptural Glass Corn. We will meet an artist who tackles growing corn and blowing glass with equal verve. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.